Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today, today I want to talk about the creation of Yugoslavia during the Paris Peace Conference and the complexities of relations between Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, Bosnians, and Montenegrins. And the historical forces that led to the extraordinary development of this multinational, multi-ethnic state, where previously there had been a kind of a fragmented former provinces of the Ottoman Empire and nations that had emerged in the 19th and first decade of the 20th century and forged into their current state. But in 1919, by obviously the experience of the First World War. There had been, since January 1919, a 100-strong Balkan delegation in Paris, made up of a variety of academics, intellectuals, soldiers, former deputies in the Vienna Diet of the Austrian Empire. And these were men who had been basically ignored for the first few months of the Paris Peace Conference. The great powers saw their role as firstly extending their own interests, in the case of Wilson, developing the League of Nations. And the questions of smaller nations really are largely academic to particularly Lloyd George and Clemenceau. When you look at states like Poland and Czechoslovakia, they are of interest to the delegates, or to Lloyd George and Clemenceau particularly, because there is the means of creating this cordon sanitaire around the Soviet Union, around the new Bolshevik state, soon to be called the Soviet Union, and between the new Bolshevik state in Russia and Germany, to prevent either from meeting up and being able to have a shared border, such were the suspicions about both. Having two relatively democratic states allied with a generally quite a liberal democratic capitalist and Western, therefore, outlook in Central Europe was immensely strategically important, particularly as far as Clemenceau went. This interest didn't extend as far as Yugoslavia. And so even though the war had begun in the Balkans with the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, the actual fate of the Balkans seems, but in the eyes of Lloyd George and Clemenceau and Wilson, to be a secondary issue. There were delegates from the Balkans who fought on different sides during the First World War. Some had fought for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, others had fought for Serbia, and of course the delegation was enormously religiously divided. There were Muslim delegates, Catholic delegates, Orthodox delegates, and then there was a wide variety of political persuasions, from monarchists to socialists to other radical nationalist persuasions. And so managing to steer all of these disparate groups towards one unified nation-state, more multinational than nation-state, was going to be extremely difficult. And the fact that this is achieved at all is one of the truly astonishing achievements of the Paris Peace Conference. And then, really, the longevity of Yugoslavia, having survived a Second World War and surviving all the way up to the 1990s, again, is really, people look up exclusively on the breakup of Yugoslavia at the end of the Cold War. And the reality is that actually the longevity of stability in Yugoslavia throughout the 20th century has been quite an achievement. Slovenes and Croats, who lived along the Adriatic, were very concerned that Italy did not get a foothold along the Dalmatian coastline, and were greatly concerned about the possibility of them being handed over wholesale to Italy as part of Italy's peace dividend at the conference. The Serbs thought that handing Dalmatia over to Italy might benefit Serbia in the long run, and allow the Serbs to access larger chunks of territory if a Yugoslav superstate eventually didn't emerge. For a long period of time, the proposed and planned new state didn't have a name, though there was dispute over the name, and eventually the union of, or the state of, the Southern Slavs, or Yugoslavia, is decided upon. One of the fallacies about the Paris Peace Conference, and I think we looked at this when we discussed the creation of Poland, was that the conference doesn't really create any Central or Eastern European countries, and certainly doesn't create Yugoslavia. It really ratifies the existence and recognises the existence of Yugoslavia. The actual negotiation, the actual discussions that were had happen between Yugoslavs or between Balkan peoples long before they are presented to the Supreme Council. The casting vote, really, at the Paris Peace Conference comes when the Allied powers decide how to respond to this new nation-building project. Will they undermine it economically? Will they encourage other states to gobble up the territory that has been earmarked for Yugoslavia? Will Italy be given the Dalmatian coastline and Fiume, for example? And these were the ways in which the Allied powers could undermine and prevent a Yugoslavia emerging if they chose to. And so that was what really the nature of the negotiation was about. It was about aligning nationalist projects with the interests of great powers and making sure that those neatly dovetailed together. Italy, of course, is the main obstacle to the creation of a Yugoslav state. Italian nationalists looked upon Yugoslavia as an enemy, and not only did Italian nationalists now need a sort of a spectre of an enemy in the place of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that had fallen apart. But also, Yugoslavia claimed the obviously the Dalmatian coastline, as we've discussed. But Yugoslavia also represented the possibility of a successful state on Italy's borders. That would throw up a rather unflattering mirror to Italy itself, a country that was one language, one culture, and one faith, but extremely divided, and a country of its own internal divisions and discords. It was the USA who first recognised Yugoslavia. The British and the French felt duty-bound to back the Italians. Even though they saw the Italians as opportunists, they knew that the Italians had suffered huge losses during the war, but their actual contribution to victory in the eyes of the British and French was pretty minimal. Quite how the Italians had secured victory, the British and French argued, was difficult to see. And the antipathy that America had for Italy, and had also for Italian ambitions, for Italy's desire to hoover up these kind of irredenta lands to the east, was clear. Wilson was far more scathing of Italy's ambitions to create its own expanded territory than it was of the British ambitions to acquire essentially new colonies through the umbrella of the mandate system. The crunch time for Italian relations with the other powers came in June 1919, when the Allied powers finally recognised the new state of Yugoslavia. And this decision constituted really a direct rejection of Italian ambitions. Now, the head of the delegation, Nikola Pazic, who had previously been the Prime Minister of Serbia, a man in his 70s, who was imbued in the Serbian national folk spirit and culture, the kind of resurgent Serbian nationalism that had emerged in the years prior to the First World War. He was clocked right away by Lloyd George as being a kind of a powerful and crafty political operator. Lloyd George asked when they first met whether Serbs and Croats spoke the same language. The Balkans were an immensely confusing place to Lloyd George, and there was a kind of a lack of expertise on the kind of the complexities of the Balkans.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lack of specialists amongst the British delegation. It was generally known that, or believed by Lloyd George, that the Balkans were a very dangerous place, somewhere where you tread carefully, somewhere where all sorts of unexpected things politically diplomatically can happen if you're unwary. And that constantly, from the 19th century onwards, the Balkans have been a source of potential warfare. Pazic had grown up in Serbia following the independence from the Ottoman Empire, but had really existed within the empire's shadow as the empire, the Ottomans, retreated from the Balkans. And the effect on an entire generation of men like Pazic was to arm them with a kind of a cunning and a wariness that perhaps other politicians didn't have. And he announced his intentions to virtually nobody. He was a great Machiavellian figure, a great keeper of secrets. And if you imagine that, you know, another Machiavellian figure like Lloyd George, whom incidentally we'll be reviewing a book on in the next week or so, found Pazic untrustworthy and complicated, that gives you a clue as to the sort of person Pazic was. One of the themes within Serbian history since the mid-19th century had been that of expansion, of creating a greater Serbia, a union of Serbian peoples. And this is particularly why the annexation of Bosnia in 1908 by the Austro-Hungarian Empire is such an enormous affront to Serbian nationalism, as Bosnia had large numbers of Serbian people living there, who wake up one morning essentially finding that they are now citizens of subjects of the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg crown. The idea that Serbia could become this greater entity and could really incorporate all of the Balkans had survived the war and existed in the post-war era. But this nationalism, this resurgent new nationalism, was shared by large numbers of other Balkan peoples, such as the Croats, particularly. Churchill said quite observantly of the Balkans that it produced more history than the people there could consume. And Pazic found that he had to share the delegation with another powerful Balkan nationalist, Ante Trumbic of Croatia, who was the new foreign minister for the planned Yugoslav nation. Of course, as far as the Serbs were concerned, they didn't see it really as a kind of a pluralistic exercise where there would be a kind of like a federation of Balkan peoples on an equal footing with one another. They saw it as a project to create a greater Serbia. And much in the same way that for much of its history, the United Kingdom really has been seen by English politicians as a kind of a greater England, and the Anglification of Celtic parts of the United Kingdom has been seen as kind of a fairly natural and normal process from a kind of an ethnocentric, as of Anglocentric perspective. This perhaps is something that inevitably happens when you have larger, more powerful, dominant groups in a kind of a federation of nationalities. Trumbic had a very interesting historical kind of perspective on the creation of Yugoslavia. He had worked for many years to create a Yugoslav state, and he had been a subject, as a Croat, he'd been a subject of the Austro-Hungarians, whereas obviously Serbs had been dominated by the Ottomans. The view that Croats had of the Serbs was, in many ways, poor and fortunate. They had been dominated by this kind of barbaric Asiatic peoples, and instead of living and operating in the heart of European civilization, the the Austro-Hungarian Empire, by and large. As Christopher Clark points out in his book, Sleepwalk is a very well managed and very prosperous and very efficient imperial polity, who had kind of an advanced process of administration and politics. They looked upon Serbs as being inheritors of all the bad things that the Ottoman Empire seemed to represent. Trumbic said to a French journalist who was speaking to, "You are not going to compare, I hope, the Croats, the Slovenes, the Dalmatians, whom centuries of artistic, moral and intellectual communion with Austria, Italy and Hungary have made pure Occidentals, or Europeans, with these half-civilized Serbs, the Balkan hybrids of Slavs and Turks." Trumbic's view from 1914 onwards had begun to change, however. His affinity towards the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been in steep decline. And in 1915, he had spoken out in the company of various co-collaborators on the need to create a Yugoslavia, and he set up the Yugoslav National Committee in London as exiles during the war, believing that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was finished anyway and the war would present an ideal historical opportunity for this to happen in. Now he had wound up on the same side of as Pazic, as Britain wasn't allied with Serbia. At this point, the Serbs were interested in simply Serbian expansion as opposed to a federation, and it wasn't considered by the British that the Austro-Hungarian Empire might actually collapse, or that if it did, that would even be desirable. And so in 1915, the trouble began with Italy when at the Treaty of London, a secret agreement was drawn up which offered the Dalmatian coastline to Italy. And it was this offer that was refuted by America. When America came into the war, America said, we're not a full ally of the British and French, so we're not bound by the agreements that they have come up with in the past. In fact, we are an associate power, and we actually don't recognise some of the shady deals they've already made, so we will not be bound to endorse them at any point. There was a small group of Balkanists in London journalistic and bureaucratic circles, including the First World War journalist Wickham Steed, who saw the Austro-Hungarian Empire as some kind of a monstrosity that needed to be put out of its misery, and rather liked the new states that were emerging in the Balkans. And at the end of the war, men and women who had been bitterly opposed to one another and fighting one another, you have to remember that Belgrade was razed to the ground as 120,000 Serbs were killed, and much of the shelling was done by Croat and Slovene and Bosnian soldiers of the Austro-Hungarian army. Getting people round a table to agree to create a kind of a federation was extremely difficult, but amazingly, it happens. Part of the reason is the removal of Russia from the role as patron of Serbia. Now, the Russian Revolution had ended this filial kind of nationalist paternalism from Russia to Serbia, Russia's northern Slavic big brother role, is abruptly ended. This gives Serbia less of a guarantee of protection in the international order. Obviously, the big enemy of Austria-Hungary is now gone as well. However, in its negotiations with other Balkan states, it has less leverage because it knows it hasn't got the backup of the USSR at all. And so this makes the idea of a federation, which it believes it can dominate, more attractive. It probably isn't going to be able to call itself Greater Serbia, but Yugoslavia has quite a ring to it, and this now might be the way in which these nationalist dreams are actually realised. And looking at the objections of Italy, it was easier for people like Trumbic and Pasic to see that the Italians carried very little weight with the British and French, and could eventually be outmanoeuvred as the Allied powers had a great deal of antipathy towards the Italians, and also had little knowledge of the workings of the Balkans, and this could be played to the negotiators' advantage. We'll continue with this topic in due course. This is something I've been interested in for some time, and I'll catch you and talk more about this on the next Explaining History podcast. You guys can pop by our Facebook page, say hi. There's a Facebook group, I beg your pardon. There's some interesting conversations happening there, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.